Welcome to Net Front Presence. I'm Matt DeFrance, the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, joined by Nathan Mills, also of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. On today's episode of Net Front Presence, we have a discussion about the last week of Blues games between their loss to Chicago and their win over Dallas. And then later on, we'll be joined by former Blues broadcaster John Kelly, who will be making his return to St. Louis later this week. So, Nathan, these first two games, these last two games, really different. Really different. I mean, they had a blowout loss to Chicago where the goaltending wasn't good. There really wasn't much of anything to fall back on, maybe outside of Jake Neighbor scoring another goal. And then they show up on Saturday against a really good Dallas team and turn in probably their best game of the season.
Yeah, it's been a roller coaster, right? Like, it was a tale of two games, and it felt like a tale of two teams. And I'm not talking about the opponents. I'm talking about the Blues, right? The defense was not there at all against Chicago. The goaltending was not there at all against Chicago. Even the offense, really. I mean, I know they scored three goals, but they didn't look great against Chicago. And then you come back against the Stars, Cup contender Stars, and it seems like they've woken up. The defense is there. They look the best they've been all season. Bennington was like 8 minutes from shutting them out or something like that. I think there's even maybe later than that.
Like two minutes.
Shutting them out. Yeah. I mean, and the offense looked like they were, I mean, they were hounding, I can't remember the Stars goalie's name right now. Ottinger. Jake is that Ottinger, right?
Yeah.
That's right. I'm still learning all the extra goalies. I just only care about ours, you know? but yeah, so they were hounding him at the net front all night long. And it just looked like the best game they've played all season long.
Yeah, in that game against Dallas, Jim Montgomery talked about it after the game pretty explicitly. He said, you know, the thing he liked most about how they played was the way that they checked and the way they played defense, the way that they got sticks in lanes, they disrupted plays. And I think part of that, is the juxtaposition against that Chicago game, when they were basically giving up a ton of odd man rushes. I mean, it was bad pinches by defensemen, turnovers in the offensive zone, and suddenly the Blackhawks were going the other way. And, you know, they didn't even score on all of them. I think back to that first period with Joel Hofer, and he makes that pass to Ilya Mikheyev. He was intended for Pavel Buchnevich, and instead finds Mikheyev. When I talked to Hofer the next day, a story would come out soon in the Post-Dispatch. He said he thought Buchnevich was the center, which would make it a different route, which would have a different pass there. So just a little misunderstanding on his part that kind of led to a turnover and a goal. But with Hofer, you think that when he handles the puck well, and he does, he's one of the best puck handling goalies in the league. That's an indication of him being on his game when he's doing it well. And when he's not, you think he maybe doesn't have it. So you go through that, you know, it becomes a tie game, and suddenly that bad goal on Reichel just kind of slips through him. So you're wondering where Joel Hofer's head is at, and he makes a big save on Tyler Bertuzzi on a breakaway, another big save on Reichel when he kind of cuts through the defense. So you're thinking, okay, he's back. He kind of put those two goals behind him. He's going to be locked in for the game now, and that just wasn't the case. So I think the combination of Hofer not being on hands, the defense allowing defense and forwards, I guess, allowing a lot more odd man rushes, high danger chances to the Blackhawks, like that was their bad recipe, right? And so you're kind of worried about that when you have a team like the Stars who you started the season 3-0. They've now lost two in a row now, but they were the second to last remaining undefeated team in the NHL before this past two-game stretch.
Yeah, I was on Hofer's mindset. I'm so glad you've got something coming on that, because I thought for sure after that first goal, and then, of course, you know, the Blues equalized, and then there was the second Blackhawks goal shortly after that, I thought, oh, no, he's in his head. This is going to go sideways, and then it did. And I'm glad to know that that's not the case. It's just a bad game, you know, which happens. But
when I talked to him, this would have been Friday after practice. It was kind of an odd day as a reporter, because you go there, they have all these changes to the lineup. And then, you know, I was talking to Logan Mayhew about his play and Joel Hofer about his play. And partially it felt like they weren't true therapy sessions, obviously, but it felt like it in a way where, you know, they were able to kind of talk through their mistakes or mindsets and kind of spin it forward. So when I talked to Hofer, one of the things that he talked about was that one game doesn't define who you are as a goalie, and it's the best league in the world, and sometimes it's going to happen. It doesn't mean that he's accepting of it, but one of the nights that him and I talked about was, I think it was 3.5 years ago, spring of 2022. He was a full-time AHL goalie for the first time in his career. He was splitting the net at the time, I think, with Charlie Lindgren. And he gave up 7 goals in back-to-back starts. And that was the last time that he had given up 7 goals in a game. And so I asked him, like, yeah, I mean, I think it'd been a long time since that happened. And he told me that he was thinking about those games on the drive home. That on the way home, he was thinking about those games and how, you know, he came out better for it, that he came out on the other side, that one game didn't kind of decide who he was. Because at the time, I mean, he's, I think, probably a 21-year-old goalie who's, I don't know, 21-ish, we'll say, that had just given up 7, a touchdown in back-to-back games. So the fact that he's able to look at that with perspective and kind of handle that mental side is a good thing for the Blues. And also, like, the mental side is a lot with the goalie. Like, him and I talked about, how do you even reset during a game? Like, it's really hard because the next shot is coming momentarily. There's not a lot of time to dwell on past mistakes. And, you know, something he said was like, yeah, I mean, once the goal goes in, you can't do anything about it. Like, that goal's gone. Like, it's time to focus on the next one. And so, you know, obviously it didn't show in results against the Blackhawks, but I think the mentality and the mindset of a goaltender is such that you have to have a short memory sometimes.
Well, and one of the things that, or primary things, I guess, that Montgomery's always, you know, praised about Hofer is his confidence. This is a guy who's not rattled. This is a guy who, he wants the net as often as humanly possible, and he's ready to get back out there next time. So that I love hearing that. That makes me feel a lot better about Hofer, because I think we've talked about this before on the podcast, that I love the guy and really would can't wait to see him be the number one guy down the line when it's time for Binnington to hang up the mask, right? But right now, having those two together is great. So being able to bounce back from that is great, and having Binnington in the goal against the Stars was much better.
So yeah, with Hofer, the way that he handles the puck, the way that he has a ton of confidence, he has a certain swagger about him. And I think we can forget with a game like Wednesday against Chicago that he also had a great game against Calgary. Like, yeah, that's a huge piece of the Blues season so far. Like, if they open the season with a 5-0 loss and then the goalie is just average in Calgary, they're opening the season 0-2 after all these expectations. Potentially they're gripping the sticks a little tighter, they're kind of playing not as loose, you're going into Vancouver, and they played a great game there, but you wonder about the effects of kind of what their mind is like at that point if they don't have a win, and how much that game in Calgary can kind of set up the Blues at that time for really to get on this mini run. And, you know, they're 3-1 in their last 4 games.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, and one I hadn't really considered, that Calgary game. He won that Calgary game. You know, well, I don't want to say the Blues were outplayed, but that game was closer than the score looked, and he stole some shots from Calgary that probably should have won them that game. So in the context of his full season, yeah, that seven goal loss looks bad, right? And it is bad. I don't mean to dismiss that, but in his defense, he won the game in Calgary. He's going to get another shot. He's going to win more games this season. So I'm not worried about it in the grand scheme of things, but it was not fun to watch live. Yeah,
yeah. And as we talked about defensive play, Here's a name for you, Jordan Kyrou.
So glad you brought him.
I think on Saturday against Dallas, you know, there was a lot that he did right. Tracking back in the neutral zone, picking off pucks. Like, even the goal that he scored was, I don't want to say 100% him, but it was, you know, maybe 80% him.
80, yeah.
But, you know, he picks off a pass from Alex Petrovic in the neutral zone, whirls back the other way, enters the offensive zone with speed, holds up the puck in the corner, finds Shen going down the wall, and then opens himself up in the slot. And he opens himself up in such a way where it looks like he's ready for a one-timer, and kind of fakes that and takes the puck to the hash marks and is able to beat Ottinger from there. So it had been, it wasn't a trying start, I would say, for Jordan Kyrou, but he's a goal scorer. And when you don't have any goals in the first four games, like, that's just not the production that the Blues have expected out of him. I mean, he's good for, you know, around 35 goals a year, 30 to 35. Like, that's kind of been where he's been at. And if you're not scoring, then in the past for him, it was, what else are you doing? But now I think his game has kind of evolved a little bit to the point where he can affect the game without scoring. I think about that assist he had on the Shen goal in Vancouver. And, you know, he finished that game with zero shots on goal, but he very well could have had a bad shot on goal on that play. But instead, he held up the puck and waited for Shen to join him. So it's been kind of a growth or maturation in Kyrou's game over the last few years that got him to this point where the Blues are a little more comfortable with his two-way play.
Yeah, so he's a guy who, you know, a lot of, like, preseason pundits had talked about, maybe not a lot, but some preseason pundits had talked about as being a candidate for regression. And so it looked like in the first four or five games here that you know, that may come to fruition. And then, of course, he scored last night, started getting that going. And then I'll tell you what, not last night, I guess it was Saturday night, and got that going. But I'll tell you what, the best play I've seen from him so far this season was in that Dallas game. And it was he probably skated 150 feet across the ice to get his stick in front of a shot and help out his goalie. And I don't know that I've ever seen him skate that far to make a defensive play before, but I love seeing that. I mean, I take notes when I write, when I watch the games, you know, writing stuff down on my phone and typing. And I can't read you what I wrote because I'll probably get fired or in trouble because there's a curse word and some exclamation points at the end of it. But I loved that play. I mean, it was hustle, it was heart, and that's what we need to see from Kyrou. And finally, we've seen it. I hope he's ready to get going for the rest of the season.
Yeah, it's interesting that you bring up the regression topic with him because it's been something that I think a lot of people kind of just wait for with him. You know, he is a guy who has an above average shooting percentage for his entire career. You know, like, his entire career is 13.6. Like, if you had a goalie that gave up goals on 13.6 of the shots against him, I think that's 86.4 as a save percentage. Like, that's, you're in the AHL at that point. He's making goalies look horrible. Or
you're Joel Hofer against the Blackhawks.
I think that math might actually be even worse for him on that night. But this is a guy who, like, year after year has been sort of a volume shooter and a lot of outside shots too. So the expected goal value of those are going to be lower. And he generally outperforms them. You know, I like to use Money Puck as a resource for things like this. They have a metric called shooting talent above average, where they look at the expected goals that a player produces, how they scored, how that compares to the rest of the league. And, you know, I think we all know each shot from an area on the ice, like, it has an expected goal value, but it's different for each player. Like, it's different for Jordan Kyrou that's there versus Matt Kessel, right? That's just the way it is. And so this tries to quantify just how different that is. And when we look at his numbers from last year, you know, they had him as, you know, almost 30% better than the average shooter. The year before it was, you know, 26. The year before it was 27%. So he's consistently in that 25 to 30% range of being a better shooter than the rest of the league. And that's something that the Blues can kind of count on a little bit. And that's why he can be a successful player with a lot of perimeter shots. I think a lot of times in his career, that was a knock where you'd want him to get more inside. You want him to be between the dots, below the dots in the inner slot area, because that's where goals are scored. But he scores goals from the outside as well as a lot of other, as well or as better than a lot of other players in this league.
Yeah. What can you attribute that to with him? Like, I mean, he's got a good shot, don't get me wrong, but he's not a guy who you hear anybody talk about as having, you know, an elite shot, right? And if he's that much better from the outside, that's what it would feel like is going on. Is his shot that good? And I don't realize it. Or is his speed playing into that? Is he one of those guys who's in the right spots? Help me understand Kyrou's scoring ability from the outside.
Yeah, I think a lot of it is his shot. He's able to, I don't know if jet it off quickly is quite the right word, but he's able to pitch spots, I think, pretty well. I mean, even if we look at that goal against Dallas and Ottinger, I believe the expected goal value was something like 6% or something like that. That's a play where, yeah, I mean, he beats Ottinger, above the pad, below his arm, and maybe some other times you see that as a save, but he's able to pick his spot and find the hole and score a goal. So, it's one of those things where, yeah, it is just his shot. I mean, I'm looking at last year's NHL leaders in shooting talent above average on Money Puck, and your number one is Leon Draisaitl, number two is Mikko Rantanen, number three is Artemi Panarin, and number four is Jordan Kyrou. So that's kind of the class that he's in. And even when we look below, I see number five is Andre Kuzmenko, and I'm kind of like, what are you doing here? But number six is Pasternak, and number seven is Jason Robertson. So you have, I believe, everyone there has scored 40, and many of them have scored 50. Panarin has a 49-goal season. Draisaitl, Rantanen, and Pasternak have gone past 50. Robertson, I think, got to 46 or 47 one year. So, that's kind of the class that Kyrou is in as a goal scorer.
Well, I would love to see him get up to 45, 49, 50-plus goals. That would be great.
Yeah, I don't know if he's going to get there, but that's kind of where his next target would be, right?
Listen, I'll take the 35 he's producing regularly if he'll keep making defensive plays like he made against Dallas. That just made me so happy. It tickled me.
There you go. And the last topic here at the net front is just that the Blues have kind of reestablished a defensive identity. This was something that really led them through a lot of parts of last season after Jim Montgomery took over. They were one of the best teams defensively in the entire league in terms of preventing scoring chances, holding shot totals down. They were in the top, I would say, 3 to 5 teams across a variety of different defensive metrics. And I know the 12-game win streak gets a lot of credit for that. And Robert Thomas, after the Four Nations, he was one of the best players in the league. But it was kind of the foundation of their defense that showed a little bit of signs before all of that, before the big run. There was the signs of defense kind of improving and trickling in. And that was something that we probably wouldn't have thought about 2 or 3 years ago when the defense was among probably the worst in the league, as Jordan Binnington's heroics couldn't even do much to kind of save the results there. So the fact that they were able to kind of turn it around under Montgomery, and we could see that on the ice on Saturday, big development for this Blues team, I think.
Yeah, I think that's what made Kyrou's play specifically so exciting for me, is like, oh, right, there's the Blues team that we were seeing last year. There's the team that we thought could beat Edmonton in the playoffs. There's the team we thought could actually make a run. And even though they'd won 2 games so far and lost 2 brutally by that point, I felt like we hadn't seen that team yet. So getting to see it Saturday, especially getting to see it against the Stars, right? Cup contender, that felt great. So, you know, granted, it's one game. We want to see it again. But yeah, it felt really nice to see that team show up again. And I hope they stick around.
Yeah. And so when I was in Dallas, I covered some really good defensive teams, you know, under Montgomery and then under Rick Bonus. And the Bonus Stars were borderline boring. You know, it was a group of players that really prioritized getting back on defense, preventing odd man rushes, so much so that it took away from their offense. And, you know, we'd go on the road and talk to other reporters, and they'd be like, that first period was the most boring one that I've seen. And Saturday wasn't quite to that level, but there were times where I was like, man, they're checking so well. They're not even allowing Dallas to get going. Like, this is just kind of a forecheck contest at times where it's dump after dump. And it wasn't quite up to the level of the Rick Bonus Dallas Stars in terms of entertainment value, but it was to a point where you're looking and saying, wow, like, yeah, they're really holding them down. And it's a little bit, it's not as up and down as it was with the Blackhawks game. There's a lot more kind of half court, so to speak.
Yeah, and it felt like, too, the pressure was on the whole game. I mean, I feel like even against Vancouver and Calgary, it didn't feel like a full 60 minutes performance, right? Versus Dallas, it very much felt like the full 60 minutes finally came together. They started out, I don't want to say hot, but, you know, kind of really tight defensively in the first. Second, of course, the offense gets going. And in the third, it felt like they started to slow down a little bit, but still it was there. You know, the only real breakthrough by Dallas is the one goal very, very late in the game. And that was hardly a breakthrough at that point, especially after Suter's little empty net poke, which my son thought was hilarious that you could do that in a professional sport.
Great play, though.
It was beautiful. I mean, he barely got any stick on the puck at all. He just slid it exactly where it needed to go. My son is 6. He's about to turn 7, and he's watching the game, and it's one of the first hockey games he's ever sat down and actually watched all the way, you know. And as that puck is just slowly, you know, sliding in, and I don't remember which Star was coming in after it, he's going, no! Yeah. You know, so that was fun. But, yeah, it's you know, it felt like a full 60-minute effort. And you know, I know that you don't get that every single night over 80-plus games once you get through the Stanley Cup playoffs. But, you know, if we get more of these, especially against Cup contenders, I feel a lot better about where the Blues are going. But, I tell you, the big thing for me, like I said, is that defense finally showing up. I mean, the offense, I'm not really concerned about the goaltending in the grand scheme of things, even with that game from Hofer, I'm not really concerned about. But the defense is a big deal. And having the Montgomery, the Montgomery touch finally show up, that's what we'll call it, felt good.
We want to get set up for our interview with John Kelly, former Blues broadcaster. We talked about him returning to St. Louis after his contract was not renewed over the summer. We talked about his adjustment to LA and the Kings, some of his favorite moments in St. Louis throughout his 21 years as a Blues broadcaster, and even how Doug Armstrong and Joe Buck may have factored into his job right now, the messages he received from Braden Shen and Jordan Bennington. So we covered a lot of ground with John Kelly, and here's that interview coming up next. For Nathan Mills, I'm Matt DeFrance. We're pleased to be joined by the one, the only, John Kelly. John, nice to see you. Nice to talk to you.
Matthew, how are you doing today, my friend? You doing well?
Oh, it's a lovely day in St. Louis. I mean, it's probably not quite the weather that you have out there on the West Coast, but it's beautiful. The leaves are starting to change, and a little chill in the air this morning.
You know, I like that. And, you know, that's something I will miss from St. Louis. I think fall is probably my favorite time in the Midwest with, you know, the chill in the air and, you know, Halloween and then Thanksgiving and change of seasons and all that stuff. But I'll admit, Matthew, I live about 3 miles from the ocean, and it's about 72 degrees every day here in Manhattan Beach. So that's pretty good as well. So I'm not complaining.
Yeah, it's not a bad thing. I think I remember like any time we would go through LA, I would almost make a point to like rent a bike on Manhattan Beach or Santa Monica and just kind of bike up and down. There was one day I just rented like a little cruiser and biked from Manhattan about Rosecrans and Manhattan and biked all the way down to basically like past Redondo Beach, down that way and then back. And then at the end, I did the math and it was like 18 miles on a cruiser. And then I was like, I don't know how that was possible on a one speed cruiser, but it's just so nice and flat and beautiful out there.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, for St. Louisans who've never been out here, the bike pass and the walking pass, they just go for miles along the Pacific. And it's flat and it's beautiful. And you go through all these little beach towns. It's pretty cool. So yeah, we're enjoying ourselves a lot out here.
Yeah. How's the adjustment been with a new team, you know, obviously working for with the Kings now, how has that been, after spending, you know, close to or more than two decades with one team here in St. Louis?
Yeah, it's been really good. Everybody, from, you know, management to the coaching staff to the players, they've all been really good. The only player I knew coming out here was Joel Edmondson.
Yeah.
And everybody else I had to meet and get to know a little bit. It's still a little bit of a challenge to meet all the staff, you know, the trainers and the coaches and some of the front office people. I'm still trying to learn the names. It helps if they have a number on their back, but those guys don't, Matthew. So. But, you know, it's been really easy. And as far as like, you know, getting to know the team and calling the games, that really has been the easier part because, you know, as you know, I did three Kings games last March, two out in LA. So I know that I knew the Kings really well coming in and they only have three or four new players this year. So that part of it's been easy and working with Jim Fox, their longtime analyst here, who's been outstanding. He's so well prepared and easy to work with. And, you know, my wife and I rented a house in Manhattan Beach. So, you know, the personal side has been going really well. But I guess the biggest challenge is trying to learn all these names and faces that are so new. You can imagine, you know, there's probably whatever, 40, 50, 60 employees. And that's been the trickier part, but it's all good. We're really happy out here.
Yeah. I mean, I think people probably don't realize what the travel party looks like, right? Like you have the 23 players, but then you have four, five, six trainers. You have a coaching staff that's six to eight people. You have management that's always around, the other media folks, you know, the other broadcasters, a producer, PR, digital team, social team, and that's just people who travel, right? Like they're it's a whole organization. So I mean, yeah, I think when you talked about the kind of the 2.5-3 hours being the easy part of the game, it's everything else that's it's different.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, you want to meet as many people as you can, and the fans have been great to me. They had a after their last preseason game, they had a fan fest where the fans could meet the players and the coaches and the broadcasters. And, you know, fans came up to me. A few fans made pictures for me, like, welcome to LA, John. It was really nice. Actually, there's one other person I knew coming out here, Matthew, former Blue Nelson Emerson, who is the assistant general manager of the Kings. He's been out here a long time, and I called Nelson's games for a few years when he played for the Blues in the early 90s. So that's the other guy I knew coming out here. And obviously I knew the broadcasters, but it's been great. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah. And so when everything happens this summer, obviously you knew that Nick Nixon was retiring. Was this a spot that you kind of eyed a little bit once you knew you were looking for a new job?
Well, it was the only job open. So yeah, I really eyed it a lot. Yeah. I did. I mean, you know, the day I was informed on July 9th, I made a few phone calls to see if the job was still open because I had known that Nick was retiring. He told me that in March. It wasn't a secret. And I assumed that they had either hired a person by that time or they were very close to hiring someone. As it turns out, I know they had some people that they were talking to and were interested in hiring. And then I threw my name in the hat, and some people really helped me, made some phone calls to, you know, sort of advocate for me. And it was very nice of them to do that. One of them was Doug Armstrong, and I'll be forever grateful. So, you know, I got my name in the hat, and 3 weeks later, I got an offer, and I guess the rest is history. But I'm so fortunate that Luc Robitaille and the Kings and FanDuel Sports Network gave me this opportunity because, as I said, Matthew, this was the only job available. So if you would have asked me a couple of years ago, could you ever see yourself working in LA with the Kings? I would have said, I don't think so. You know, they have a really veteran announcer, and he'll probably announce forever like Vin Scully did out here. But, you know, life sometimes throws you curveballs, and I got a curveball this year, and lo and behold, we got this job, and now we move on. So that's the way it is.
Yeah. And when you start, you know, looking at this new job in the summer, like, I'm sure there was a kind of a grief period. You know, when you find out from the Blues, like, how are you able to kind of emotionally, mentally turn the page and start looking elsewhere once it happens?
Well, yeah, it wasn't a 24-hour process, I'll tell you that, because from the day that I was informed on the 9th until I got the offer about 3 weeks later, there were a lot of sleepless nights that I had and my wife had, and it was tough for my immediate family, for my 3 kids and for, you know, Jennifer and me. But, you know, I think anytime somebody's life is sort of turned upside down like that, it's expected. And it was a shocking turn of events for me. And I didn't see it coming. But, you know, as I told you, Matthew, when it happened, and a lot of other people, that, you know, I look back at my 21 years with great memories, and I focus on that and not on one decision that was made in one day. And right away, I turned the page, and I literally, as I said, I inquired about the Kings job. The next day, I reached out to Joe Buck to see if he could help me get some games with ESPN. He did that, and I have a handful of games with ESPN this year, which is fantastic. So I think that's the only way that you can really go about something like that happening, is to move on and to put your best foot forward and try to get another job. You know, it's sort of funny, Matthew, when it happened, you know, the day or two after it was announced, a lot of fans or people on social media said, oh, John's retiring. And, you know, that was the last thing on my mind. So I was focused on getting another job, and I didn't get one, I got two. So again, very grateful for that, and very thankful.
Yeah. And not retiring, you just love doing it, right? Like, I'm guessing that's the reason why you don't want to step away, is it's something that you love doing.
Yeah. I, you know, I'm in my mid 60s now, as you know, I'm an older guy, Matthew, but I feel great. And I still think that I can do a good job announcing the games. And I love hockey. I watch hockey every night, as you probably know. And just, it's very passionate for me to do this job. I can't imagine doing anything else. So, you know, until I lose the passion for the job and the love of the game, and I might never, I want to continue working. Obviously, I'm not going to work forever. I want to, at some point, enjoy, you know, retirement and hopefully grandkids and stuff like that. But right now, I have a strong passion to continue doing it, and that's my plan.
You know what, JK, when I was kind of thinking about it and how much you love watching hockey, I was like, you know what, this is probably a great situation on the West Coast, where if there's an off night and you can turn on a game at 4 o'clock out there, and then the late games are really just the normal times for you, like, that's ideal for watching hockey.
No, it is. You're right. And I love it. You know, really, on the weekends, the games start at sometimes 9:30 or 10 in the morning.
Wow.
No, like, you know, like the Capitals with a game on Sunday.
Yeah.
It started at 12:30 Eastern time. That's 9:30 my time. So I can watch a hockey game at 9:30 and then a few other games, you know, watch football, obviously. So, yeah, that's a big benefit of being out here is that I don't have to stay up till 12 or 1 o'clock watching hockey and sometimes obviously not finishing the game. So I love those 4 o'clock starts are really, really enjoyable. Trust me.
Yeah. Now you mentioned ESPN. I want to talk to you about that. So you talked about how Joe Buck kind of helped you get in there. How different is it broadcasting a national game versus a regional game? And I think you had that one with Vegas and San Jose, that crazy ending out there.
Yeah.
Like how different are the two jobs really?
Well, you know, I think they're quite a bit different in terms of you have to be 100% neutral on a game like that. But I have some experience doing it, Matthew. Back in 97, 98, I did some games for Fox when they had, you know, yeah. Big Fox, when they had the NHL rights. And I was one of, I don't know, 5 or 6 announced teams. I worked with Craig Simpson, who's now the number one analyst on Hockey Night in Canada. So I did like 7, 8 games that year. In the 06 playoffs, I did a couple of series. I don't know, maybe 10 games total for NBC Sports Network. So I have some experience. And obviously, watching my dad his entire career, you know, he did 16 Stanley Cup finals and was the TV voice in the United States for most of his career. So I watched his game. So again, getting back to the mindset is that, you know, you don't go into the game with sort of a dog in the fight. And, you know, obviously when I'm announcing a Kings game or before that, the Blues, when they score, I'm going to be a lot more excited than when the other team scores. But so I really think it's, you know, right down the middle, 50-50. And, you know, in a way, it's easier because maybe you don't get frustrated if your team is losing or if there's a controversial play, you know, you don't have to worry about necessarily what you say. So in a way, it's a little bit easier. But then again, it's more challenging because when I do a game, and a lot of people have asked me about this over the years, you know, how do you remember all the names? But when I'm doing my own team, I know that team. So yeah. Right away, you're eliminating 50% of the players that you have to know. You just have to concentrate on the other team. But when you're doing a national game, you have two teams that are a little bit unfamiliar to you. So it is more challenging in that aspect.
Yeah. And then in St. Louis, when you were, you know, calling games, you know, on the regional network here, you had Darren Pang as a partner for quite some time, right? And then the last 2 years, you had Jamie Rivers. And now I believe, I mean, you tell me if I'm wrong, but like Jim Fox is doing a lot of them, but there's also working with Tony Granato and Ray Ferraro. And Jared Stoll, you're going to be having some national games with, you have different analysts. Like, where's the, how do you kind of find the rhythm with different analysts, different color guys, you know, that you're rotating in and out?
Yeah. You know, because I've been doing it, quite a few years, Matthew, I've worked obviously with quite a few different analysts and I've never had an issue with it. I think that my mindset is that the analyst needs to be a big part of the broadcast. And I've always liked to defer to the analyst a lot, even during play. So I think that the guys I've worked with enjoy that. And Jim Fox started in broadcasting really when I did, about 1990. So he's been doing it a long time. He is as prepared a broadcaster as I've ever worked with. I'd say he and Darren Pang are the two guys that come to the game and they just have so much preparation. So it's really easy. So that part of it has been seamless. So I think the other thing is that, you know, if you go into a broadcast and you have a new partner for a night or whatever, if you have passion for the game and respect for the person you're working with and you let the egos, you know, go the other way, and you don't have an ego, it's really easy and it's seamless. So it's not about how many words I say or how much FaceTime I get. It's really about having the best broadcast possible. And if that means the color person talks a lot more than me or whatever, that's fine. But, you know, it's really changed, Matthew. You know, in the older days, like going back to when my dad announced and, and you know, say before the mid-80s, the play-by-play guy did the play-by-play. The color guy never jumped in. And then when the whistle went, then obviously it was the opposite. But now it's more of a, in a way, it's more of a conversation for a lot of the broadcast. And I think that's just the way it's evolved. And I think it's good for the viewer. So I think it has changed. And I think I've embraced that. And I think it's good.
Yeah. How much do you think the, I guess the sped up timeout, so to speak, like the 20 second faceoffs, like that, that changed probably a lot. I mean, the analysts had a little bit longer before, and then they have 20 seconds to get their thoughts off, and then boom, another faceoff coming.
Yeah, it's, I think, honestly, I think that doing color commentary in the NHL is probably one of the hardest broadcasting jobs, just because, as you said, they have those hurry up face-offs, if you will. And nowadays, they don't blow the whistle when the pucks are along the boards anymore. They used to do that all the time. I mean, we might have a period where there are only, you know, five, six, seven whistles. And as you know, there are three TV timeouts a period. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we also have promos we have to read. So there are some nights where we have a lot of information, Matthew, and we have anecdotes and stories and things like that, but there's just no time. And you can't go into the game saying, I'm going to say this, or I'll get this story in. Because you have to sort of, you know, obviously go with the flow of the game and let the game dictate the storylines instead of the other way around. But yeah, I think it's challenging for especially the color commentator to get in and sometimes, you know, tell stories and things like that, because the game is just so fast.
Yeah. And as we talk right now, the next game you call will be back in St. Louis. Kings versus Blues on Tuesday. What do you kind of anticipate that being like, that whole experience being back here?
Well, as you know, I've come back to St. Louis before as a visiting broadcaster. Yep. So, you know, if I had worked my whole career, I've done 37 years in the NHL. If I had been in St. Louis 37 straight years and never worked for another team, it would be an entirely different situation. But the fact that I have worked for other teams and come back to St. Louis, then I've experienced that. But having said that, I was in St. Louis for 21 years. So, yeah, as you know, saw a lot of great games, you know, was there when they won the cup, et cetera. So it's going to be emotional and, you know, a lot of fun to come back. You know, obviously I will always have ties to the Blues and the city and the fans. My dad's banner's in the arena, as you know, the press box named after him, his picture's up there. So
your picture's up there too.
Yeah. I was like 8 years old at the time, in the booth. It's actually one of my favorite pictures. So
it's a great picture.
Yeah, it's a great picture. So yeah, it'll be special. But I'm not an emotional guy, Matthew. So, that's just the way I am. But believe me, when I see a lot of familiar faces and fans or staff, people I've worked with, it'll be great to see everybody. So I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah, and a month or two ago, whenever you sat down with Frank Cusimano and did an interview with him, I heard you mentioned Braden Schenn gave you a call. You know, when all the news happened, just what did that call mean to you to receive from a guy like Braden?
Well, it meant a lot. Braden has become one of my favorite players all time that I've covered. I've gotten to know his parents really well, especially his dad, Jeff, who, you know, made all the father trips and came down a lot. And I've met his brother, Luke, a few times. They're just a solid family. And, you know, for me to get a call from the captain of the team, a guy that I have so much respect for, it really did mean a lot. And he was so nice. And I also heard from three or four other players, all the leaders of the team, and Bennington sent me a note. So, and obviously a lot of other people in the organization. So yeah, for the players to reach out to me, they didn't have to do that. It really did mean a lot, and I appreciated it.
All right, let's take a walk down memory lane now. 21 years is a long time. It's a lot of games called. It's a lot of goals. It's a lot of playoff games, a lot of big goals, game-winning goals. When you look at those 21 years, which moments jump out to you the most? And let's put the 19 run aside for right now. We'll come back to it in a little bit. But outside of that run, what kind of moments jump out to you as being ones that your favorite ones to call and to kind of see the highlights of?
Well, I would look back at maybe three goals that really stand out. Number one probably would be Steen's shorthanded goal against the Kings.
Against the Kings, yeah.
Yeah, in I believe it was 13, game one, when the Blues took a double minor in overtime. And then Quick, the goaltender, got caught back in the net and Steen stole the puck and the Blues scored and won the game. And my partner, Darren, of course, he gave a holy jump in and I said, oh my God, a shorthand goal by Steen, et cetera. And I think the call came out really good, but that was really such a memorable game because I personally have never broadcast a game, a playoff game, where the winning goal was scored, a shorthanded goal. So that was unique. I think the other ones would be
unexpected goal too. You know, you don't expect a goal to come out of a mishandle behind the net. And
no, exactly. You know? Right. And the Blues, obviously, they won the first two games in that series, and then the Kings won the next four. So yeah, even though they had a great start to the series, but that goal stands out. The other two would be the Cup year O'Reilly scored a goal. I'm not sure if it was shorthanded or not, but the Blues had killed a penalty. It was a very weird scenario. I don't think you were here then, or were you here in the Cup?
No, I was in Dallas.
Yeah,
at that time.
So, I think it was Parayko who lost his stick. It was a tie game, and it might have been overtime, but either way, it's regular season. Parayko lost his stick, and anyways, Parayko threw his stick to another player. And they said it was illegal because he has a longer stick than normal. And they said that this player was using an illegal stick. It was a bizarre call. Yeah. And the Blues killed it off, or they scored a shorthanded goal. O'Reilly scored on a breakaway. So that was a memorable game. And the other one has to be Brower's goal in game seven against the Hawks in 16, mm-hmm. when he sort of fanned on the puck right in the goal crease. And then on the third try, he knocked it in behind Corey Crawford, and that was the winning goal in game seven. And of course, the Blackhawks entering that series, they had won three Stanley Cups in 5 years, including the year before they had won their third cup. So the Blues knocked off the defending Stanley Cup champions, the Blues' hated rival, and Brower got that goal, you know, fairly late in the third period to give the Blues the win.
Yeah, and even last year, I think during that 12-game win streak, like, there were some memorable moments. Like, I look back at that Detroit game where I think it was Kyrou scored to tie the game late. Fowler wins it in overtime. There's some memorable moments during that run, I think, too.
Yeah, I think they had two or three overtime wins in that run.
Yeah, is that right? Like that, yeah. Yeah. I think there was one maybe against Vancouver that they gave up one of those 6-on-5 goals and then might have won it in overtime or something like that. But yeah, there's a heck of a time to be around the team at that point too.
Yeah, that was the record setting win streak. Another goal that really stands out to me was in the Cup year, Shen scored in overtime in Tampa Bay and the Blues won 1-0. And that was in the midst of their 11-game win streak. And the game before that, they came back in the third period in Florida, I believe with like three goals. They were down 2-0. They won the game. And then the next game in Tampa, again, against a really good Tampa Bay team, Shen scores the winner. And I really felt after that game that this team was going to go on a run. I didn't think they were going to Stanley Cup at that point, but I really felt that, you know, because they went toe-to-toe with Tampa Bay and won the game, that I felt that something special was really building. And as it turns out, it was. So that's another goal that stands out. It was Shen's overtime winner in Tampa Bay.
All right. I want to talk to you about a couple sayings that you have. You know, I don't know if cash phrase is quite the right word. You know, that's kind of a little kitschy, right? But, you know, unbelievable, with the emphasis on be unbelievable, right? And yeah. And thank you. Talk to me about the origins of those. Where did it come from? How did they kind of come to be part of the John Kelly Let's?
You know, I don't know. Unbelievable just really began organically. You know, I don't know, a while ago, maybe 15 years ago, I just started using it on bigger goals, but it's not scripted, Matt. And quite honestly, it just happens when my team scores a big goal. As far as thank you, it actually began when I was with the Blues the first time. My last year before I left was 91-92. Brad Hull scored an overtime goal against Chicago in the playoffs. And I said at that time, thank you. And I got a good reaction on it. And I just didn't really think a whole lot about it. And then when I went to Colorado a few years ago, I started using it. And I just used it a lot there. Probably too much, quite honestly, because I'm not one that really thinks that you need a catchphrase.
Right,
Most announcers don't have one. Mm-hmm. A lot of the great announcers don't have one. But I used it a lot in Colorado. And then when I came back to St. Louis in 04, you know, I used it a little bit. But unfortunately, Matthew, at the time, the Blues were not a good team. So I didn't get to call enough goals back then. And there weren't a lot of big goals. So I really honestly have gotten away with it. I bet in the last 10 years, I've used it 10 times. And I don't know if I'm going to use it anymore. So, you know, that's the genesis of those phrases. But I do believe, honestly, that I've tried scripting things at times and coming up with, you know, words or phrases to use. But in my experience, the best calls are usually just done off the top of your head and with your heart. You know, one last year I really liked was when the Blues tied a game late with the goalie pulled and Neighbors scored the goal, but I wasn't sure because it was a mad scramble. And I said in my call, I said, they score whatever I said. And, you know, maybe Neighbors, I don't know. I don't care. And I think fans liked it. And it, as it turns out, it was a cool call because that's the way I felt at the time. Like they scored, but it doesn't really matter who scored the goal. They scored the tying goal. So, you know, you can't script that kind of stuff. So, you know, things happen naturally. And I think those are the best calls.
Yeah. And it captures the moment, right? Like in the moment, I'm sure the people at home don't even know who scored and they don't really care either. Right. So like you're speaking the same language, right? I think about last year, I think there was a couple saves that that you had to have Jordan Bennington arrested for. You know, you were calling the cops on him a few times.
I think I said, call the cops, call the FBI.
Yeah.
I've used call the cops quite a bit over the years. I think a lot of announcers do, but I never used call the FBI. I think I said that. I can't remember. But you know, when you're into the game, Matthew, you're announcing the game and you're emotional. You're like a fan, quite honestly. But you're calling the game. So, you know, the best things sometimes just come out just with emotion. And that's the way it should be.
Yeah. And when we look back at the 21 years, I mean, you mentioned when you first got back to St. Louis, they weren't all that good. And then in that time, you see them knocking on the door for quite some time in the late teens or mid to late teens, right? You see them win the cup, they kind of go through a little dip and then now they're back in the playoffs and trying to get back in that hunt. What has been that process to see the growth, evolution, maturation, different kind of looks of the team throughout your time in St. Louis?
Yeah, you know, it certainly was a roller coaster. Remember, I came from Colorado, and that team in my 9 years went to the West Final or Finals 6 times in 9 years, won two Stanley Cups.
Mm-hmm.
And then they had the lockout. I came to St. Louis, and guess what? they finished last overall. It was a shock.
A little bit of a change.
Yeah. No Peter Forsberg, no Joe Sakic, no Patrick Waugh, not to be critical or whatever to any of the players they had. But the team obviously was sold at the time. And, you know, they traded Pronger and let some other guys go, including Dimitra, and had a real challenge. So, but, you know, it was really exciting. You know, they drafted Eric Johnson. I know they traded him a few years later, but then they started drafting the likes of David Perron and TJ Oshie and Berglund, and the names go on. And you could just see it building. And then when Doug Armstrong took over, you know, he was very aggressive with the things he did as the general manager. One of the first trades he made literally was getting Halak from the Canadians. And, you know, he was a good goaltender for the Blues. Unfortunately, he couldn't get them over the hump. But they had really good teams. I would argue, Matthew, that some of the teams that they had, you know, during that time frame from, you know, 13 to 18, you know, on paper, those teams were as good or as deep as the team that won the cup.
Yeah.
Obviously, sure. The difference is that I think really two things. Binnington was obviously the X factor. He came out of nowhere and just had incredible numbers and stole games and was incredible in the playoff run. And they had their best players step up in the playoffs that year. And, you know, O'Reilly obviously scoring, you know, goals in four straight games in the final, and so many great stories. And, you know, Jaden Schwartz with big goals, and, you know, that energy line of Barbashev and Sonny and Steiner was so pivotal. So I think that's the other thing, is that the reason they won was that they had top players and key players step up and win them games and series. And they didn't have enough of that during those other years, because that's what it takes. Sometimes it takes one guy to win you a key game or a series. And they had that in 19.
Yeah. And without that 19 cup, I wonder if we look at that era of Blues hockey similar to the Sharks when they had all those years being a top team, or the Canucks being a top team with all those years of the Sedins. Even right now, the way that we look at the Hurricanes or the Stars as teams that are perennially in it, but have yet to get over the hump, you know, but the Blues were in it and they finally got over it back in 19. So yeah, history is told by the victors, right?
Right. You know, those are great comparisons, because the Sharks, they went to the final in 16 after beating mm-hmm. the Blues in the third round. And I believe they lost in six that year.
To the Penguins,
even yeah. Nashville went to the final yeah. and lost, I believe, in six to Pittsburgh
yep.
in 16 or 17. One of those years. But Carolina, a team that I saw the other night, you know, they've gone to three conference finals in the last 7 years and can't get over that third round hump. So it's really hard. And as you know, Matthew, the Blues came this close in game seven against your Dallas Stars.
Jim Montgomery's Dallas Stars.
Yeah, on a Jamie Benn wraparound that Binnington miraculously stopped on the goal line. They came that close to losing that series,
yeah.
but they didn't. So, it's hard to win. It really is hard to win. And we see that year in and year out. I mean, Florida last year, you know, they obviously were a powerhouse team again, but don't forget, they had to win game seven in Toronto, and, yep. you know, they won easily, but still it's a challenge to win a game seven on the road. So there are 32 teams, only one wins. And, you know, I really feel sorry for markets, Matthew, that have never seen their team win a cup. I'm not talking about the new markets like Seattle and mm-hmm. even Minnesota, but I'm talking about Vancouver, Buffalo. They've been around yeah. since the early 70s. Teams that have never seen their team win a Stanley Cup. And thankfully, the Blues did. And, you know, the Kings won their first in 12. So it's such an incredible experience for everybody, but especially the fans. You know, in a way, you wish all the teams could at least win one, but that's not the way it works.
Yeah, one out of 32. That's it. Those are the odds every year, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, well, JK, this was great. I look forward to seeing you on Tuesday, and truly hope that you get the reception from the fans you deserve, and you get everything that that you deserve on Tuesday, being back in St. Louis. So great to chat with you, and I'll see you at the rink on Tuesday in a few days. All right.
All right, Matthew. Thanks for having me. I enjoyed it very much.
All right, that was JK. I'm Matt DeFrance. This was NetFront Presence.